I think economists and decision makers at the highest level in America and elsewhere run into serious trouble when they don't take a long historical perspective. Now, let me give you a little example about why I think environmental historians are important in understanding something that's very worrying to us at the moment, and that's the nature of climate change. We now know that climate is changing very fast. The worst weather in history that we actually know of, according to the written record, was in 1791, when the strongest El Niño current ran. Now, the El Niño current is a vital determinant in the way that the world's climate works. Now, the point is that if one wasn't a historian, one wouldn't actually ever get to know about that 1791 El Niño, which is, in fact, provides us with vital raw material to understanding present climate change. Mm. And that's just one little illustration of why historical research is terribly important.
Environmental historian Richard Grove, next on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to the Center's weekly radio magazine about books and ideas. Richard Grove is here to talk about his new book, Green Imperialism. Soundings is made possible by funding from TIAA CREF, providing financial services exclusively for people employed in education and research, offering pension, tax-deferred investment, and insurance products. Here again is Richard Grove.
Well, I think probably most Americans think of environmentalism, and as they also think of conservation, as part of the American dream, and that it originates in the late 19th century. They think of it in connection with redwood protection, the Yosemite National Park, and people like John Muir and George Perkins Marsh. Mm-hmm. Now, what I'm interested in doing at the moment, and my book Green Imperialism really sums up some of my arguments, is to say, well, let's take a new look at environmentalism and what it means and where it came from. And we come up with some quite surprising answers, because it seems that worrying about the environment and the origins of conservation and the origins of what we can call environmentalism really began in a number of different places, quite a lot earlier, in fact, than they began in the Western United States, particularly in the French and British and Dutch colonies in the tropics, not in the temperate lands at all. And that if we really want to understand how environmentalism began, we need to take a careful look at the beginnings of colonization in the 17th century and in the 18th century, and particularly at the history of anxiety about the environments of islands, and particularly remote oceanic islands, where the symbolic significance of islands is a very important part of the story of environmentalism.
Richard Grove is a senior research associate at the Australian National University. He also coordinates the Global Environmental History Unit at the University of Cambridge. Richard Grove recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a project about the East India Company and environmental medicine. His latest book is entitled Green Imperialism, an account of colonial expansion, tropical islands, and the origins of environmentalism.
Well, now, you've put a lot of issues on the table, Richard. Let's move back to the year 1770. You write about the period between 1770 and 1850. And talk to us about Mauritius. Now, this is an island in the Indian Ocean. I dare say that most of our listeners would have a tough time, as I would, putting a finger on a map and saying, there's Mauritius. Why is it important to you as a historian of the environment?
Now, Mauritius became a French colony in 1716. When it was annexed by the French, they took it over from the Dutch, who had abandoned it as a colony. They had used it as a supply of ebony trees, and they'd really worked it out. And they'd also made the dodo extinct, as is fairly popularly known.
What was it, 1600 and
the
something?
The dodo seems to have died out towards the end of the 17th century. We don't know the exact date.
Yeah.
In fact, it's popularly thought the dodo died out because it was eaten by ship's crews, and that's part of the story. But probably a more important part of the story is that the environment in which the dodo lived, which was the dry lowland ebony forest, was all cut down. So, in fact, there was nowhere for the dodo to live.
Uh-huh.
Now, the French, having taken it over, realized that Mauritius was going to be a particularly useful place to grow spices. Now, at that time in history, in the mid-18th century, spices were an enormously valuable commodity, and anybody who could control the spice trade in growing spices and moving them to Europe could make a lot of money and could finance their imperialism. Now, the French were very jealous of the Dutch achievements in the East Indies in this respect. Mm. And what they realized was that if they could beg, borrow, or steal, and in fact it was steal, spices from the Dutch, they could then move them to little islands like Mauritius, which had very good soil in the Indian Ocean, and grow spices themselves. Now, in fact, the Dutch didn't want them to do that, not surprisingly. Mm-hmm. And so they ended up doing it by stealth.
Well, now we have the popular contemporary notion, Richard Grove, that when we speak of environmentalism, we have a very divided picture. We've got the rapacious capitalists and developers on the one side, and then we've got the conscientious and the, you know, the sort of bleeding-heart liberal environmentalists on the other side. I'm sure you're going to tell our listeners that that is an unfair stereotype in both directions. My question is this. Is that the kind of mindset and scenario that would be characteristic of what you call environmentalism, low those hundreds of years ago, when we speak about Mauritius and the French and the Dutch?
Well, you might say that early environmentalism was very market-oriented. Uh-huh. It wasn't very romantic right at the beginning, uh-huh. because the first person really to get into it in a big way was Pierre Poivre. Now, he was...
Not a household name, exactly.
Now, Pierre Poivre was a Jesuit priest. Right. And he was brought up in Paris, and he became a missionary in China and Vietnam. And he was a great expert on both those cultures and learned their languages. And he was a prisoner in Canton for 4 years. Now, that's important because he picked up a lot of ideas from the Chinese about irrigation, tree planting, and conservation. Hmm. Now, when the French realized they needed to have spices grown on Mauritius, they got him to move spices from the East Indies, where he really operated as a spy, and from northern Vietnam. And those spices he then took to Mauritius in a series of expeditions, three expeditions to Mauritius. Mm-hmm. Now, the point about this is that when he tried planting these new spice trees in Mauritius, he found that there were all sorts of problems, and you had to be very sensitive about the soil conditions. Now, once you started talking about the soil conditions and the rainfall, you started to think in a bigger way about the whole island environment. Mm-hmm. And he then started to become worried about the effects of the very radical and extensive deforestation that was taking place on Mauritius.
Now, the word climate comes to mind. This is important to your scholarship. Again, you were writing about environmentalism in a period of time that may be sort of surprising here, you know, back at the end of the 18th century. But climate, even though science is not what we know it to be today, climate was a concern on the minds of what? People like your Frenchmen and the Dutch, and in fact the English. I mean, we have to come eventually to this word imperialism, but set the stage for that for us.
People think that worries about climate are something new, and we probably all heard about global warming, and we may think that these are just a few decades old. But in fact, they really started right at the beginning of the 17th century. Probably the story begins in about 1705 in Cambridge, England, where a man called Stephen Hales, who was a student of Isaac Newton, became very interested in how transpiration took place. And he wrote a book called Vegetable Statics, in which he outlined a theory linking trees to the atmosphere and to the moisture in the atmosphere. Hmm. Now, the logical follow-up on that Stephen Hales spelt out in his book in 1723, was that if you cut down trees, that the amount of moisture in the atmosphere might be reduced.
So even though science back then was not what it is today, you have a certain element of common sense at work. As Yogi Berra would say, you can see a lot just by watching.
Well, that's true. But the interesting thing is it wasn't the English who took up these rather novel ideas. It was the French, who were really much more clued up about science, partly because of their new Academy of Science that had been founded early in the 18th century. And they, and particularly a man called Duhamel de Monceau, took up Hale's ideas. And Pierre Poivre, out on Mauritius, was familiar with these ideas, partly because he'd been part of a scientific society in the town of Lyon in France. And in 1763, we know that Poivre gave a major lecture on the subject of deforestation and climate change. And that seems to be where the story begins.
How do the Scots get into the act, Richard Grove? You make the case that Scottish doctors, Scottish botanists, are important to these early notions, to the history of environmentalism, as you're making the case back there in the 18th century. How about this?
Well, you see, the thing is that it was really the Scots who were more interested in French ideas, scientific ideas, as part of the Enlightenment,
right,
than any other nation. And their universities, Glasgow and Edinburgh, St. Andrews and Aberdeen, were very much like French universities in the sense that they were taking up a lot of the new ideas very quickly. They were interested in science. They taught very good medical courses. Mm-hmm. Now, the point about it is that it was the doctors in their training who had to learn botany as a part of their training, who very rapidly realized the importance of these French ideas as they were developing about the connections between deforestation and climate change.
Well, now, correct me if I'm wrong, Richard, but this is about the time when modern medicine begins to make discoveries about circulation and inhalation and exhalation and you know, breathing, the way the human mechanism works. And have I got it right that they would extend that logic, that sort of medical research, into the environment?
Well, I think that's right. It partly originates in the Newtonian foundation of the ideas about transpiration and moisture in the atmosphere,
right,
and the connections with trees.
Uh-huh.
Now, it's been thought by a lot of writers, and particularly by Carolyn Merchant recently, that in fact Newtonian ideas and mechanistic ideas actually account for a lot of the environmental damage that started to take place in the 17th century.
Hmm.
Now, in some ways, I would take the opposite view. I would say that environmentalism was only made possible because Newtonian ideas helped to explain mechanisms in the world connecting, for example, tree cutting with changes in the level of moisture.
Mm-hmm.
But it's probably a bad idea to just connect the origins of environmentalism to new scientific ideas like that, because there's another very important element, which is the rise of Romanticism, and almost more important, an increasing popularity of the idea of the island as a metaphor for utopia and for the ideal and for a new society.
Right.
Now, this was very important for the French.
When you say the romantic and romanticism, Richard, I mean, the word that comes to my mind is the organic in contrast to the mechanical. So here we have this disparity between Newtonian physics and this rather more elaborate, enterprise or design in coming to the history of environmentalism.
Well, I think that's right. And the way to sum it up is by thinking about Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who's behind a lot of this, of course,
yeah,
although the ideas don't actually start with him. But Rousseau pioneered a reaction to mechanistic thinking and also to a whole range of urban thinking by elevating nature to a new importance.
Fair enough. Let me stop you for a moment. Would Rousseau and the idea of the noble savage, does that connect in any legitimate sense to the cases that you were making about the origins of what we call environmentalism?
Absolutely, it does. When Bougainville took his first scientific voyage around the world in 1766, he began in 1766. When they reached the islands of Tahiti, they were ready to see Tahiti as a utopia, not just a beautiful place,
right,
but also as a place where an ideal society might be found. And in fact, even before they reached it, they were ready to see it as such. And what they believed they found in Tahitian society was an ideal society in an ideal environment. And it's those two ideas linked that are very important.
Well, now, and here we come again to islands. We've been delaying this part of our conversation, but talk to our listeners about why islands are important to you. You find on islands noble savages, for one thing.
I think what develops towards the end of the 17th century is an idea increasingly Europeans try to conceptualize the tropics and the extra-European world in terms of the island. And a lot of scientific travelers were, in fact, very fed up, I think that's the best way of putting it, with the societies they came from.
Early tourism, huh?
Applies particularly to the French, where in the run-up to the French Revolution, there was a great deal of intellectual and popular discontent. Now, I think they hoped to find in islands, which were obviously very carefully circumscribed geographical areas, the possibility of founding new societies. And the thing about Tahiti is that because they thought they'd found it there, they then thought that they might be able to recreate or to establish for themselves new societies on other islands. And this is the significance of Mauritius as a French colony.
Right.
Because what the physiocrats, who were a particular intellectual circle of the day, hoped to set up, and in fact did set up to some extent, was a new kind of society. This is before the French Revolution. Now, one of the things about that society was that not only would they hope it to be more equitable, but that also it would protect the environment. Now, the point is that by protecting the environment, they also hoped to lay the foundations for a better kind of society.
Richard, is it fair to say, as you look back at the history of environmentalism and environmental isms, was there ever a time when we didn't have doomsayers or naysayers, people who were coming along and saying, time out, we got to stop polluting the oceans and ruining the forests? Is that as recent as we might like to think it is?
It's been there probably since the mid-18th century. Huh. And one of the reasons for it is that after the beginnings of the 18th century, European exploration and exploitation of the rest of the world, and particularly the tropics, was gradually growing as Europe consumed more and more resources. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing is that early scientists, and the Scottish are particularly important in this story, were very sensitive to deforestation. In Scotland, it had happened as a part of the conquest of Scotland by the English after 1700, when the British troops had, when the English troops had burned the Scottish forests. Now, in India, where most of the scientific services after about 1770 were actually Scottish, they were manned by Scots and some Irish, with a certain amount of anti-Englishness involved, they became very much concerned about the uncontrolled deforestation that was taking place in India. And to come back to your point, yes, indeed, the Scottish scientists, who most of whom were medical doctors, saw the possibility of preventing this deforestation, and they had their own partly romantic reasons for doing that, mm-hmm. but also some very good medical reasons connected with water supply and disease. They saw that if they could frighten the East India Company into forest protection, right. then they would be doing something quite effective, and that's what they did, very much in the way that environmentalists find themselves having to do it today. It doesn't mean their facts are wrong, but what they say to governments is, if you don't protect this forest or protect this environment, then disaster will ensue, whether it's in terms of climate or the loss of species or the inability to grow food anymore.
Right.
But it's cyclical, because scientists or environmentalists will use the possibility of environmental disaster to force governments to act, and that's nothing new.
Richard, as you look about and take the measure of the interaction between policymakers and environment here in the 1990s, is it possible for you to say that we have a model someplace on the face of this planet, a country, a society, a group of politicians or thinkers where things are working the way you, as a historian of environment, would want them to work?
Americans have a major problem. There's a small number of people living in a very large country with enormous resources. This allows them to be profligate with their resource use, to use too much timber, to burn too much gas, to use too much land for housing and agriculture, without really having to worry about the long-term consequences, or so it seems. But if you look at very small countries, and Mauritius even now is a case in point, it's a little island, but it has to sustain a population of more than a million, ask the question, how does it manage and how does it see the dangers? The fact is that a country like Mauritius, which is westernized, which is fairly well off, it's quite prosperous, it has very high standards in education and health and so on, but it's had to look after its environment very, very carefully. A high percentage of the island, 25%, is covered with forest reserves. They have to be very careful about the amount of gas they use and so on. And so there are certainly lessons for the United States in smaller countries that have had to, in a sense, that the alarm bell has come very much early for them. And eventually it'll come for this country too. So it would be best to think ahead and to look at some examples of other countries.
So the watchword would be, the bigger you get, the more risk you are going to run as a society interacting with any given spot on the globe in the environment.
I think it's probably true to say that most countries in the world, and particularly, if you like, in the old world of Europe and Africa, and particularly in Europe, have had to think much more carefully about the way they use their resources. They tax their gas much more heavily. They look after their forests more carefully. And I think that sooner or later that Americans will be confronted with these problems. And I think that the ordinary citizen should look very, very carefully at the arguments put forward by the great multinationals and the corporations, who frankly aren't terribly interested ultimately in the standard of living of the individual in terms of the environment. They're thinking of their own bottom line. So you need to be very critical when you hear arguments for excessive resource use put forward and say, who is this going to benefit, them or me?
Richard Grove, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Let's talk about here. You live your professional life as a historian in the 18th and first part of the 19th centuries. Let's talk to our American, North American listeners primarily about environmentalism in terms of names like John Muir and Henry David Thoreau and Aldo Leopold. Are these characters important to you as an historian of the environment, even though you are making the case that, you know, it all begins considerably earlier than we might like to think? Why are they important to you?
The reasons why these Americans are very important is because, in a sense, they popularized the idea of conservation, and they wrote a lot of books, and that's critical because a lot of the earlier environmentalists I was talking about, although some of them, like Bernardin de Saint-Pierre, who was another of the people on Mauritius, wrote interesting and environmentalistic books, they weren't very well known. And the point about John Muir, George Perkins Marsh, Aldo Leopold and others, is that, and particularly Thoreau, is that they pioneered a new idea about nature that became widely known and widely publicized, and if you like, became a part of the American psyche.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they are important for that reason. But interestingly, John Muir, who's one of the major pioneers, he was in fact a Scotsman who was born in Dunbar in eastern Scotland, and if you go to there now, you'll find his statue in the marketplace. But Muir, in a sense, he isn't just an American, one of the American conservationists. He also comes from a tradition of Scottish environmentalism, which grew up in eastern Scotland, and particularly Fife and the area south of Edinburgh, during the 1760s and 1770s.
So the word global comes to mind. I mean, you, after a fashion, you're making the argument that environmentalism, by its nature, cannot be a kind of local proposition. It is always going to have continental or global implications.
That's absolutely right. People like George Perkins Marsh were very influential. He wrote in 1864 his great book, Man and Nature. He was very influential in India.
Hmm.
But then, if we look at, for example, people like Franklin Benjamin Huff, who's the man who started the American Forest Service, and in fact, you could say is the first American conservationist, he got a lot of his ideas from conservationists in India.
Mm-hmm.
So environmentalism was a truly global proposition.
Richard, where is environmentalism as a cause, as a kind of political enterprise and project, where is it for North Americans in the 1990s? Are we as a society on the right track when it comes to doing the right things, taking the right steps to preserve the environment for future generations? There's a small order for you to consider here as we conclude.
Personally, I think the picture at the moment isn't very optimistic, and the environmentalists and the conservationists are losing out very, very steadily. They're fighting a losing battle, particularly over forests, particularly over water pollution, and particularly over CO2 emissions leading to global warming.
Mm.
So I'm afraid I can't be very hopeful, but I think what is important is that American environmentalists, in a way that perhaps other sections of American society aren't, are very internationalist in their outlook, and they realize that if we're going to stop the world becoming truly unlivable, we need to think internationally about the atmosphere and about forest protection. And that's something I'm optimistic about, because American environmentalists are leaders in that way.
Richard, a footnote to our conversation. Why are you personally passionate about the environment? Am I reading this conversation as a signature of your personal passion, or are you dispassionate and merely historical as you come to this subject?
Well, I was brought up in Ghana in my early childhood in West Africa, which used to be known as the Gold Coast. And there, I was, from an early age, I became very used to walking through the high equatorial rainforests. And I think in a very basic way, they had a huge emotional impact on me. They were extremely beautiful. They were full of wildlife. But one also saw them being cut down because it was one of the major export crops for Ghana. That was hard, sappily, and tropical hardwoods.
Mm-hmm. So this and had an impression on you personally.
I was very aware that they may not last very long, and indeed they haven't. I was right in that respect. And I think that alerted me to something more general that's been going on in the world.
Richard Grove is the author of Green Imperialism, available from Cambridge University Press. Richard Grove recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. He serves as Senior Research Associate at the Australian National University and coordinates the Global Environmental History Unit at the University of Cambridge. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings is made possible by funding from TIAA CREF, providing financial services exclusively for people employed in education and research, offering pension, tax-deferred investment, and insurance products. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for an audio tape of this program. Listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. For an audio tape, call us at 919-549-0661 or send $10 to Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Our email address is sounding, S-O-U-N-D-I-N-G, at ga.unc.edu. This week, it's program number 858. Visit our homepage on the internet at www.nhc.rtp.nc.us/8080. Next week on Soundings, writers Jill McCorkle and Marley Yeomans. They'll be here to read from and talk about their new books. Jill McCorkle's latest novel is entitled Carolina Moon. Marley Yeoman's new book is a novel entitled Catherwood. Finally, a program note. A few cabins remain on the National Humanities Center study session to the Greek islands and Turkey aboard the exclusively chartered four-masted yacht Sea Cloud. Information provided 1-888-650-TOUR, 1-888-650-8687. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.